I'm Lina Ormudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the show today, we will look at malnutrition and food security. According to the 2021 edition of The State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World, it's a joint report by United Nations agencies, the number of undernourished people rose to around 768 million. That's about 118 million more than 2019. And get this, the increase last year was equal to that of the previous 5 years combined, and most likely due to the COVID-19 pandemic. For more on the subject, I spoke with Serena Stepanovic, Senior Director of Food Security and Livelihood with World Vision, an evangelical relief and development organization. Take a listen.
Serena Stepanovic, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Can you, first of all, give us a sense of the issue of food insecurity and malnutrition? I know World Vision has been working in this field for so many years.
This is obviously a super important question, something that a lot of people are talking about right now. And I think it's an interesting moment in that historically, these conversations are a bit siloed. And so you'll see people talking about food insecurity or malnutrition or hunger in the domestic space, so in the U.S. space, and separately in the international development space. And in the wake of increased dialogue around food systems and the relevance of food systems and in COVID, we're seeing a breaking down of those silos, and that's really important for finding durable solutions. So I'll start by just providing three broad definitions, one on malnutrition, one on hunger, and the other on food insecurity. So malnutrition at its core refers to an imbalance in a person's nutrient intake. This imbalance can be in the form of a deficiency or in the form of excess or some combination thereof. I think typically when we think about malnutrition, we're thinking initially about the deficiency side of things, right? So having fewer nutrients, and that may look like stunting or wasting or underweight. And I think these are the experiences historically in sub-Saharan Africa, but certainly not exclusively. On the other hand, malnutrition, when it comes to its excess form, is also defined as obesity. And this really gives rise to a number of non-communicable diseases, including diabetes, stroke, and some forms of cancer. And it's related to, again, that combination of imbalance in terms of what a person is consuming in terms of nutrient quality. There are two key types of nutrient gap that are important to note in this space. And one is in the form of micronutrient deficiencies. So think of zinc or iron or vitamin A. And certainly in sub-Saharan Africa, this area of micronutrient deficiency is quite prevalent and a chief cause and a growing cause of illness. On the other hand, there's a lot of concern around food safety. So you think about issues such as environmental enteropathy or the way that people interact in environments where they're co-housed or located with animals. And you know, in rural communities, that's quite common. So how do you keep chicken feces away from young children in play areas? And then if that's not prevented, then what's the impact on things like gut function and the child's ability to absorb the nutrients that they are actually consuming? And similarly, among smallholder farmers, again, very significantly in some sub-Saharan African countries, you see this experience around mycotoxin exposure, which is a type of fungus. We often hear of it described in terms of aflatoxin more specifically, and you'll see this in peanut or groundnut and maize or corn crops. And it's just a reminder of how tremendously blessed we are in the U.S. and that this is not something that we have to face on a daily basis. But your typical smallholder farmer in sub-Saharan Africa absolutely has to make decisions around where these aflatoxins are present and whether or not they can sell food at market or even eat it at home as a result. So that's the malnutrition space. Hunger refers to the distress, both physical and emotional, that's associated with not eating enough food in a given day. And by not enough, I mean traditionally around 1,800 kilocalories a day. And so in the most basic terms, we can say that malnutrition refers to sort of an imbalance in the quality of nutrient intake, whereas hunger refers to sort of a strict lack in quantity of intake. Now, hunger is chiefly driven by or caused by food insecurity. So this is the third key definition, and food insecurity refers to a situation where an individual, a family, or a community don't have consistent access to affordable or available quality nutritious foods, right? And there are three main drivers of food insecurity. And again, I'm talking about sort of the global ideas, but absolutely this is relevant, highly relevant for sub-Saharan Africa. So there are three drivers. One is violent conflict. The other is sort of the set of climate change impacts. And then the third is economic shock. Any one of these can create an environment where a set of communities experience medium or long-term food insecurity. Unfortunately, in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa where food insecurity already exists, you're seeing more than one of these drivers of food insecurity happening simultaneously. And then when you add to that mix the multi-layers of impact that COVID has had, right? It first started in being seen as a health issue, and very quickly it was seen as something that had tremendous economic impact on our food systems, both in the U.S., right, and then anywhere you name in the globe. And so COVID, as we know, has tremendously exacerbated the inequalities and, you know, entrenched food insecurity and rolled back some of the gains that the world had been marching toward in terms of sustainable development goals.
Now, let's talk about solutions, looking at the work of World Vision. When people are going through hunger, suffering from malnutrition, what is being done to address these issues? What are some of the solutions?
Malnutrition and how an organization responds to it depends upon a few factors, including the severity of the malnutrition, the key audience that's affected, and the context, geographic and otherwise. Malnutrition is also responded to both in stable context, right? So your development side of the spectrum, as well as on the emergency side and any transitional space in between. And that's really important to understand. And again, in the wake of COVID, there's much greater conversation between those two sides of the spectrum within the international space. And that's quite important for us, because often you'll find interventions that might work well in either setting that just need to be adjusted, et cetera. So on the emergency side, you may see things like community management of acute malnutrition or the use of ready-to-use therapeutic food, whereas on the development or more stable side of the spectrum, you may see the use of things like timed and targeted counseling, which is really a social and behavior change approach. And across the board, you will see a focus on infant and young child feeding. So in the emergency space, that's considered really focused on life-saving approaches and outcomes. And then in the more stable context, infant and young child feeding will take a longer-term approach, looking at sustainable solutions, sustainable practices, and things that are much more driven by community agency and ownership. Exclusive breastfeeding is certainly going to be a focus, so only breast milk during the first 6 months of life, and then also attention to household and individual and community behaviors around water and sanitation and hygiene. World Vision, as you mentioned, we're a roughly 70-year-old organization. We are Christ-centered, community-based, and child-focused. And our mission really is to address the root causes of poverty and injustice the world over, but also addressing the impacts of poverty and injustice. And globally, in the nearly 100 countries where we work, you'll see a focus on food security or some combination of livelihoods or malnutrition-focused programs in more than 90% of our global portfolio. And that's because we are working in the hardest to reach places. We're working with the world's most vulnerable poor. And for some of the reasons I mentioned earlier, these are families and communities that are then traditionally impacted by food insecurity, by hunger, by malnutrition. So really excited to share a commitment that we put on the table in December, which is really just this commitment of about $700 million in nutrition grant-funded resources over the next 5 years, as well as a repurposing of about $500 million in private non-sponsorship of funding to address the drivers of malnutrition. And we're estimating, while there's going to be exponential benefit for families and communities, that repurposing of funding, that commitment is going to directly benefit about 1 million additional children. We work, obviously, in terms of direct service delivery in many of the countries where we're found. But we also work through strategic partnership, and that includes a mix of private sector partnerships with agribusinesses like Syngenta, or policy outfits like FAO, as well as nutrition life sciences firms such as Royal DSM, and a range of research partners from IFPRI to Tulane and Tango and a number of other universities.
When you look at what is currently happening with COVID that is exacerbating hunger and malnutrition in parts of the world, what can government do?
I first want to acknowledge what governments have already been doing, right? I think we saw immediately as we were all experiencing COVID in March, April, and May of 2020, that many governments, including our own, were doing the needful to shore up food supply chain breaks, right? That was the first thing that we all experienced. And in our market, some of the hoarding behaviors that also happened. But then there was also a need to address some of the food price spikes. So those things were important measures. And I think in some markets, those are still necessary. We can't talk about addressing sort of a post-COVID environment or building back better without acknowledging also the tremendous ongoing and increasing investments of our own government through U.S. Agency for International Development, USDA, as well as through multilaterals such as World Food Program, for which World Vision is its largest global implementing partner. So taking, you know, into account what's already been happening, we're also at a point where there's such strong recognition that food systems is not an esoteric academic concept, right? It is something that if we embrace it and if governments embrace that concept, we're able to drive toward more durable solutions and to amplify the impact and participation of some of the critical actors that aren't traditionally at the table. And that includes some non-traditional producer groups, non-traditional maybe small and medium enterprises, right? So not just working with the bigger entities that tend to have access to some of the longer-term government coordination mechanisms, but doing a bit more outreach. This is valuable because one way of thinking about a food system is to posit that it has to be nutrition mainstreamed. It has to be socially inclusive, it has to foster resilience, and it certainly needs to connect with the health system and have within it the agricultural market systems as well. And that's another important piece, just because some of the donor funding over the past decade had initially really focused just on the markets piece, as opposed to looking at all of the food systems domain from supply chain to food environment to consumer behavior. So when governments can embrace that concept, they can, again, bring into the conversation better and more nuanced range of partners. And World Vision, along with FAO and Action Against Hunger, spent the last year or so working with about 12 sub-Saharan African governments looking at ways to mainstream nutrition within targeted food subsectors, from forestry to fisheries, crops, as well as livestock. And lots of really good examples of ongoing government commitment in that space. So we're excited to see that work continue over the coming years.
When we look at the issue of malnutrition, a lot of times, you mentioned it actually, where we think about stunted growth and children. To what extent is there a difference between an adult who is experiencing malnutrition and a child who is experiencing malnutrition? What sort of impact are we looking at?
Malnutrition more often causes illness and death or morbidity and mortality in children than it does in adults, unfortunately. I mean, children are vulnerable, right? They're still growing. This is also one of the reasons for the global focus on shoring up nutrition during the first 1,000 days, right? So anyone who's seen the 1,000-day movement knows that the focus is ensuring that pregnant women are feeding themselves and by extension feeding their children from the moment of conception all the way through age two. That's important. And I would say there's also consistent investment on the experience of children under five. So there's that sort of focus on children under two, but it still extends out to five because the morbidity and mortality issues are still seen in that broader group. And I'd say the Lancet series has been the most impactful in our industry and sort of guiding the conversation and understanding what high impact interventions look like for service delivery, whether in the health system or outside of it in spaces such as ag or WASH and the like. So that's one angle. The other way is to look at it in terms of a life cycle approach, which is to say that today's children are tomorrow's adults. One caveat is we don't want to just look at children, especially girl children, through the lens of their reproductive potential. I do want to affirm that their health is important for its own sake, not just because girls may become mothers or are likely to become mothers in low and middle income countries at some point. But there's definitely no question that if we shore up nutrition in those early years, there are going to be educational attainment benefits, economic benefits, and the like. And those are especially seen for girls and women.
And do you have any final thoughts before we wrap?
It's really an exciting moment in our industry. Again, for those who are your usual listeners who may be most exposed to conversations around food security or hunger in the domestic space. And I think a lot of those conversations happen in smaller groups, right? Because again, we're blessed with so many resources here. The current conversation around food systems and the fact that we're all involved in local and global and national food systems in some measure, not only because we're consumers, but in many cases, because of the livelihoods that many households undertake. So we each have a role to play in shifting some of the ways that we eat within our own households. Food systems are not by default nutrition oriented. So we have to really think first about what we're consuming and why. And then also there's a great opportunity to get involved in the global conversation about how we build back better in the wake of COVID and shore up the systems that really impact us all.
Serena Stepanovic, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
That was Serena Stepanovic, Senior Director of Food Security and Livelihood with World Vision. It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Heidi Adams, host of Straight Talk Africa. Join me to explore what is now and what is next for African society, culture, and politics. We'll go behind the headlines to analyze the news and emerging trends shaping Africa today. Straight Talk Africa, every Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Welcome back to Health Chat. A new report by the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says that despite a good harvest, millions in Zimbabwe still face severe food insecurity. Adigondo gives us more on the story from Bulawayo.
The report, which forms part of the UN's Humanitarian Response Plan, surveys food supplies and health conditions among 4.5 million people targeted by the UN and its humanitarian partners. The study concludes that the coalition provided support for 648,000 people between January and March. These include 634,000 people who were helped to access health services, 335,000 who received food assistance, about 219,000 children who were being assisted in accessing education. The report says the UN's humanitarian response plan was badly underfunded, meeting less than 2% of the requirements having been received by the end of March. The UN and humanitarian partners appealed for US $84.9 million to mitigate the effects of the public health crisis and the knock-on effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on vulnerable people in Zimbabwe last August. The UN's vulnerability assessment, which evaluates food and social needs for rural people, indicates that the number of households receiving UN NGO support surged from 13% registered in 2019 to the current 33%. Workers say the new data represents a correct assessment of reality despite the bumper harvest touted by the government. Peter Mtasa of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions says The situation is dire given the minimum wage. He notes that it's far below the poverty datum line of around 80,000 RTGS or Zimbabwean dollars, which is about US$250 at the official market rate.
The working class is in a crisis in this country. The Zimbabwe Vulnerability Assessment Committee report indicated that 83% of urban dwellers, the majority of whom are working class, are failing to buy food, bread, cooking oil, mealie meal, and many other food items. These are people that are going to work daily, but they are earning useless wages in RTGS against an economy that is dollarized, where prices of goods and services are pegged in US dollars. Many families of the working class are now failing to pay rentals because rentals are in US dollars.
The government last week announced a wage increase of 50%, but workers have since criticized the increase as piecemeal and far from what they need. Economic analysts say that the report must take into account the window period between harvest and drying. Economic analyst Reggie Shoko says that there is a bumper harvest in some areas, but that's not the case in many parts.
There are some provinces that have actually failed to meet their minimal target of self-sustenance in terms of maize. Hence, the logistical management of the distribution of the harvest is very important at this moment in time, given the fact that certain provinces have challenges in terms of maize output, and also generally the fact that other areas are not good agricultural areas for cropping.
Shoko calls for a multi-sectoral approach to dealing with food insecurity in the country.
We will always have these challenges where people will always be vulnerable to hunger. But what we then need is now that UN, government of Zimbabwe, NGOs find a way of redistributing the major output of the harvest across so that the balances and reduce the vulnerability of those that are already vulnerable due to droughts, due to other challenges like corruption that are facing the Zimbabwean economy.
Observers say that the narrative of a country basking in the abundance of a bumper harvest is deceptive because it fails to recognize that millions are struggling to eke a daily existence.
On this first World Drowning Prevention Day, the World Health Organization offers life-saving solutions to prevent most of the 236,000 estimated deaths from drowning every year. The United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution in April establishing this international day to raise awareness of drowning as a serious problem. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Summertime has been celebrated in song as the season when the living is easy. On a less celebratory note, summertime in the Northern Hemisphere also is the peak season for deaths by drowning. Over the past decade, the World Health Organization reports 2.5 million people have died in drowning incidents. It says more than half of all drowning deaths are among people under age 30, with the highest rates among children under the age of 5. David Meddings, a WHO medical officer, says drowning is the second leading cause of death among children and youth under age 19 in wealthy countries such as the United States, Switzerland, and France. He notes, though, drowning disproportionately affects the poor and the marginalized.
The rates for drowning in low and middle income countries are 3 times higher than the rates we observe in high income countries. And so it's really the populations with the least resources to be able to adapt to the threats around them that are at highest risk for drowning. The Western Pacific region has the world's highest drowning rates, followed by the African region.
WHO reports more than 90% of drowning deaths occur in rivers, lakes, wells, irrigation canals, and even domestic water storage vessels in the poorer countries. It says children and adolescents in rural areas are disproportionately affected. Medding says national surveys in Africa show most drownings occur among young adult men out on fishing vessels.
For example, there was a study done in Tanzania among lakeside communities that showed that the risk of death from drowning exceeded the risk of death in that population for death from HIV, TB, or malaria. So 80% of deaths occurring in young adult men who are in a sense, obligated to go out on fishing vessels that often are inherently unsafe watercraft without advanced weather warning and without knowing how to swim.
The report does not include statistics on flood-related mortality, deaths due to water transport mishaps such as capsized ferry boats, or migrant deaths that occur while crossing the perilous Mediterranean Sea. WHO recommends a number of cost-effective, life-saving measures. It says children should be taught basic swimming and water safety skills. Wells and potentially dangerous water areas should be fenced off, and bystanders should be trained in safe rescue and resuscitation. It says safe boating and ferry regulations should be enforced and calls for flood risk management to be improved. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Health Organization is urging African countries to ramp up preparations for COVID-19 vaccination rollouts in anticipation of the imminent arrival of millions of vaccine doses on the continent. WHO reports more than 6.2 million people have been infected with COVID-19 and more than 159,000 have died. Lisa Schlein once again reports for VOA from Geneva.
New cases of COVID-19 in Africa have fallen slightly following 8 weeks of a fast-moving surge. The decline is attributed to a sharp drop in cases in South Africa. However, the World Health Organization reports the situation could change quickly as violent protests and mass gatherings in the country could trigger another rise in cases. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, says Africa's third wave is not over. She notes 21 countries, three more than last week, are experiencing a resurgence. She says the highly contagious Delta variant has now been detected in 26 countries, and 13 of them need more oxygen due to a surge in cases. She says Africa continues to lag in COVID-19 vaccines, with just 20 million Africans, or 1.5% of the continent's population, fully vaccinated. But she says Africa's supply crunch is starting to ease. She says the first delivery of doses donated by the United States through the COVAX facility is arriving in Africa this week. And altogether, nearly 60 million doses from other sources are expected in the coming weeks.
African countries must go all out and speed up their vaccine rollouts by 5 to 6 times if they are to get all these doses into arms and fully vaccinate the most vulnerable 10% of their people by the end of September. Around 3.5 to 4 million doses are administered each week on the continent, but this needs to rise to 21 million doses each week at the very least to meet this goal.
Moeti says more than 500 million doses are expected through COVAX alone this year. This massive influx, she says, means countries must up their game.
We need to address the issue of vaccine hesitancy. So this communication, targeting people, targeting the messages that we are tracking, and the misinformation or the fears and misconceptions is absolutely vital now, because the time to mobilize people to be ready to be vaccinated is not when the vaccines are landing. It is now in this narrow period of a window that we have to do all of this.
Regional Director Moeti says countries must scale up their operations. She says countries need sufficient vaccine sites, storage facilities, adequate transport, plans for distribution, and of course, health workers to carry out this life-saving activity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/voahealthchat and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and wash your hands more frequently, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young, host of the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in Nation right here, Mondays through Fridays at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for an action-packed 30-minute program of African, American, and international sports highlights.
Stay informed and up to date Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC with VOA's International Edition. Our correspondents bring you the news from around the globe, plus we delve into the context of the day's biggest stories with interviews with experts that place the story into context to understand why it matters. VOA's International Edition, your best source for news and information.